Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. I am joined, as always, by the amazing JP. Hey, JP, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Wow, that was a little rough start. My internet cut out for just like a split second, and I was like, oh no, here we go.
I say the same shit every time, so you didn't miss anything, I promise.
Yeah, I don't have to jump back into context and know what's going on with context clues. But that aside, I'm doing well. My team at Open Door is wrapping up our first iteration of this launch for being able to schedule a tour in Dallas-Fort Worth. And things have just been absolutely crazy trying to get all this stuff together, but also super fun. But now that we're winding down, I feel like I can and relax just a little bit.
Nice. That's awesome. I'm glad to hear it because I know that deadline has been super looming over you. We've both been pushing really hard on work lately, trying to get some stuff out the door. So this week, we're going to be kind of shooting the shit, to be honest. This is just kind of a do it live approach to this week. We don't necessarily have a chapter to walk through, but I'm excited because I have a couple talking points that I want to talk through about some lessons and main takeaways from Pooter. And so we're still talking through Sandy Metz's amazing work, which is practical object-oriented design in Ruby, but kind of through the lens of recent stuff and recent experience and recent findings. We try to do this between each book just to kind of give a little bit more of a casual episode that just kind of talks about our recent projects, recent challenges, and tries a little bit very loosely to connect it back to the book that we've kind of just gone through. And just like the main takeaways of, you know, you're at a meetup and someone's like, oh, you've read Pooter. Like, what should I know about it? What's the main takeaways? That's the kind of goal here, to give you the kind of shot by shot and remind you of kind of the best episode. So if you missed one or two, kind of be like, oh, this chapter is one to dig into, at least my favorite. So I'm going to pull out my favorites here. So besides pushing through this deadline, JP, I mean, that's pretty much all you've been focused on, which is all React Native work, right? Have you done any side work or looking at new things or looking at what's beyond this sprint right now?
No, I've been doing React Native stuff now for the last like two months.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
We started this push maybe in like December-ish, I think, but I knocked out a ticket yesterday that required me to do a little bit of Ruby. And you know, you haven't written Ruby in a really long time when you declare variable with like a variable, like var in front of it,
yeah,
or like var, let or const.
Let or const, yeah.
And also when you put semicolons.
Oh, that's so funny.
I'm just like, geez, I don't even know how to do this anymore.
I have the opposite problem every day with JavaScript. Like, because I usually write JavaScript every day now. I'm writing more and more JavaScript in my day-to-day life. And I always forget to do the let or const on my variables. Because you look, it's self-inferring in Ruby. If I just say something equals something, it's going to equal the something. I hate that extra syntax and I always forget it. And shit just blows up and it's just like, ugh, that's right. Okay, you don't have the variable. I just forgot a let or a const. I do like the way, though, that JavaScript handles the idea of like this immutable variable with a const versus let. And it makes me think more deeply about my variables. And I've actually really come to appreciate that idea. And there isn't really the same thing in Ruby. Like you do have a instance variable, but like everything is settable. From to my knowledge, you can't like declare something and have it not be overwritable somewhere else and have it like blow up if you do. And that's kind of where types come in a way that's very, very, very loosely related to the idea of types and just like immutable data versus non-immutable data, or mutable, I should say. But yeah, I've kind of come to appreciate that kind of distinction between it. And honestly, come to appreciate JavaScript more and more lately, just how fucking powerful Vanilla.js is. So it's so cool.
Yeah. Wow, I really have to do this before the internet people come with their pitchforks. There's a slight distinction actually between immutable and like reassignable. So const is not necessarily that it's immutable. So like if you do const and then have an object, and let's say you have like a key, and then that key points to like an array, you can actually mutate that array.
The array. From totally. The
yeah.
Thank you for clarifying that, because you're right. The Twitterverse might come with their pitchforks. Actually, but just it's not necessarily pitchforks. It's the actually, which we actually really appreciate the clarifications. Yeah. And I am by no means claiming to be an expert in my field, but that's why I love this format of just kind of learning together and talking through stuff to all stages. But yeah, so that's actually, let's talk through that distinction a little bit real quick. And so is there a way that you know of in JavaScript to actually have immutable data without a framework with Vanilla.js? I don't think so. I think you need something like all the different, type strong JavaScript frameworks to do so. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So the question is there a way to have immutable JavaScript? And the answer to that is kind of. So they have, there's like libraries out there. I think one of them's called like Mori. I think another one's called Deep Freeze or Freeze or something like that. Or immutable. It's probably immutable JS, honestly.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I think all that does is like it provides a mechanism for which when you like transpile or compile, I forget, I don't know, well, maybe we'll have Twitter correct me on that one, like things will yell at you. Mm-hmm. But to get immutable data, I think, I don't know, there's not necessarily a way. I know that it's becoming like a really popular pattern with the whole like functional programming thing,
right? Yeah.
And always having like pure functions, having like given some input, it returns some output, never mutating your data.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, to answer your question, I don't think there's like, because it's not inherently built in. For example, I know like Elixir is a language that's entirely immutable. So like you can't mutate any of your data.
Anything, right.
Yeah. Like even variables. Everything's just a linked list.
Yeah. And so, yeah, just kind of wrap up that rat hole. The idea of const versus let is const, you can modify that thing you define in this const statement. You can modify its attributes, but you can't change it to something else. So if it's like an object, you can change one of the attributes of that object. Like you could change the object's first name if there's a first name attribute or an item in its array, push or pop something into the array. But you couldn't actually change that to an entirely new object. You couldn't replace the object. And that's kind of the distinction there. But I was just saying, in general, I feel like it's kind of a nice syntax, even though I find it kind of annoying to have to put that statement and always forget to do it in Ruby versus JavaScript.
Yeah, it's nice because even though it's not entirely immutable, you know, when you read through code, the intention's there. So like if I see something that right. says like let, I might know that, you know, later on down the line in JavaScript land, that variable might be reassigned.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of, it's just like, and in even writing the code, it's just a nice way to remember like, okay, what is this variable name? What is it doing? And on top of that, with the scoping in JavaScript, and I feel like that's where as kind of a junior-ish JavaScript developer, where a lot of my bugs will creep up is like, oh, this is leaking outside of this scope, or I don't have access to that within this function. I feel like that's easy to do. And it just kind of helps me remind where things are at. And it's just like another guide to that journey. The thing I've been struggling with so much lately is in vanilla JS doing imports and exports well, like the module, the named exports versus default imports and knowing what I'm exporting versus, oh, that's such a nightmare without a nice framework to back you up on that.
Yeah, that stuff can get confusing. And I think you might not even, I don't even know if import and export syntax is like fully supported yet. I think you might need like Babel for that. I think the actual like vanilla way to do that is using like require. So if you ever seen something yes. like const lodash equals require lodash, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But in the project I'm working in, we do have the Babel tooling stuff spun up. So we're using the import export. And I didn't set up the tooling, but it's there to do so. And even still, like getting the imports, exports all wired up and passing the data between them can be mind-boggling sometimes. Like how if I want to use the result of one function in one piece of code and import that or export that into another function. I feel like I struggle that too with playing with React Native or any of those things like passing data between those imports and exports. It just gets really wonky and it's just not as clearly wired up as something like Rails, that it's like such a clear relationship between the messages and the objects that receive them. And it's really unclear to me like how all these things connect so many times. I'm not looking for you to fix it. It's just an interesting topic.
Yeah, it kind of is because we were struggling with that one problem we were having where like
yeah, the e-commerce site I was working on. Oh my God. Yeah,
where like one file was like being compiled at a certain time and but like you didn't have access to it until whatever. Whereas like, I don't know, that maybe that might not have been a good description of the problem that was happening. But
it was super similar in this idea that basically I had three different JavaScript files that I was trying to share data between them. And it had to do with, yeah, there was some dependency on how the order of which they were being like initialized, which function was being initialized when, like, did I have access to that object yet? And then how can I pass data back and forth to and from that object?
Yeah. You would hope that it would just be like a Ruby module where if you like include it, you just have access to it. Right.
You have access to it and you can pass messages to it. And that's like one of my biggest complaints. Of course, everybody's got complaints about JavaScript for all everything. For as much as eating the world, I feel like everybody's got their gripes about JavaScript and solutions to it and workarounds. But that's one of my main ones is that there isn't this clear DHH overlord passing down the best practices as clearly as other libraries and frameworks. Like, I feel like even in the world of PHP, the little bit I've had to do some things in it, there's some conventions that people all kind of agree on and work. And of course, in Rails, that's stronger than anywhere else, where we very much believe in the conventions and this is the way we do it and doing it that way. And there's very little, like, I go into other code bases on other projects and there's very little breakout from that convention and everybody follows that. Where JavaScript, I feel like project to project always has like, oh, well, this is our own little gulp or babble that does all this different stuff and we use it this way in this specific flavor of JavaScript. It's really cool that you have so much flexibility. That's one reason it's so powerful, but it's also one reason it's so overwhelming as a junior mid-level developer trying to get your head around some projects. It can be really hard, especially moving from project to project to project. Like, once you get up and running in a project, it's easy to do.
Yeah, I think the problem still is that I try to contain myself within like the world of React. And so I follow people who are like big in the React world on Twitter.
Yeah.
And it's just such a, as a community, we're still trying to figure things out. So like quote unquote best practices of yesterday are total anti-patterns now.
Right. Anti-patterns of today. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's
and
a
there's
good way
to so
say.
Many different things that have come out in the last couple of years. It was like we had presentational and container components, and then we had higher order components, and then we have render props, and now this like new thing called hooks is coming out. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, how can we just like, I don't know, decide on something? But now I think hooks are supposed to be the future. But I don't know. We'll see what happens in a couple of years. I think it's just like the growing pains of discovering this like new framework. That on top of this like really crazy interest in functional programming has just sort of shifted the way that people do JavaScript now. But there is no like DHH saying like convention over configuration, here's how we're going to do it, here's how we're going to build JavaScript apps. So like if I go into a Rails app, you know, I'm going to know where things are. I'm going to know the models are here. I'm going to know the controllers are here. If I need to figure out like why some endpoint's being hit, you know, I can always trace it down starting from like my routes file. But you can't necessarily the same thing about like a SPA, like a JavaScript front end app. It's just sort of like, okay, I'm in the wild, wild west here. I could like sort of figure things out, but I'm going to be more in the dark than if I like jumped into like a Rails app.
Yeah. And I don't think one's necessarily better over the other. I think for myself, I found a lot of value in having so much strong convention and the efficiencies within that convention. And there's less day-to-day decisions and some of that other stuff. But at the same time, it can be limiting. Like I'll feel like, oh, I just want to do this one thing and it just makes sense to have a custom controller action. And then sometimes I find myself saying like, no, like from the dogmatism of just like, no, I need its own, you know, interface with its own object. And in general, that is the right approach. And in general, following the convention is the right approach, which is funny because it reminds me of one of my favorite chapters from this book was chapter 2, which was designing classes with a single responsibility, which is no matter what you're doing, always split it into its own class model view controller. Like everything you do, and this is like, I always come back to this in our podcast, which is just break it down smaller, like split it out into its own object, split it out into its own controller, make things smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller as much as you can. It's going to, in general, err on the side of breaking things up, and it's going to be better and more maintainable and easier to change. And that's the ultimate thing that makes it more flexible. But that's not always the best approach. And I think that's one reason why JavaScript's so interesting, is because you don't necessarily have to have any kind of an MVC. You don't have to. There's no rules. You can just do whatever you want. You want to just permutate that data right in the same function that's doing the view presentation? Like, have fun. Oh, yeah, what the hell? Let's throw the inline styles in there, too. Shove all your CSS in there. And like, but sometimes that makes sense to do that. And I think also, just because you're using a specific language or framework doesn't mean your project's going to be well maintained or organized or make sense. I have written personally the shittiest and most spaghetti Rails apps you've ever seen that are way worse than the worst single page JavaScript app. And it was all written in Ruby, which is a beautiful language, but I was still writing shit. And so it's very possible to write shit with a beautiful framework. And it's also very possible to write something very eloquent and beautiful with a not so eloquent language such as JavaScript. Like, I've seen JavaScript apps that are just like really beautiful, though. I'm just saying, regardless of the paints or brushes you use, you can be an amazing or a shitty artist. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying one's better over the other at all.
Yeah, totally. Side note, I was looking at some of that old code I wrote for that mobile app.
Oh, yeah, the telemedicine one you were helping me with?
Yeah, and I was like, how did I ever live without Prettier? It's like these tabs are out of control.
Oh, I know.
Things are like not where they should be. There's a missing semicolon here. Like, what was life like before Prettier? I don't even know.
And I cannot wait for the Prettier of Ruby to like actually take over. I know like Prettier actually has a branch that they're running to try to get it actually working for Ruby, which is exciting, but it's like very slow development. It's an open source project, so go contribute. I should contribute too. But like there's another one that's called like standard.rb, I think, that's trying to do it, but I feel like no one has it. Prettier just works, and it works so well and so reliably and so efficiently. I love it, and it makes my JavaScript so much better. I just don't even have to think about formatting or tabs or spaces. I get it out of my brain, I hit save, and it works. It's awesome.
Yeah, and it's like it's a nice way of linting too, because I'll know that I wrote valid JavaScript. I'll like intentionally leave off a semicolon, and like my indication that I wrote like something that is actually valid JavaScript is that like a little semicolon will pop up.
Yeah, nice. That's so funny. Do you use day to day? Are you in VS Code? Are you in Atom? How are you using Prettier? What is your? Let's talk about like code setup right now.
Wow, I'm on VS Code now. I was very resistant to it. Yeah, I don't know why, because I really hated that little sidebar thing.
Yeah.
I did not like the sidebar activity thing, and then it had like the other sidebar. But because, you know, Microsoft is like the owner of VS Code, and I think they also like created TypeScript.
Yeah, they're huge contributors to TypeScript. Well, and they also own now GitHub, which owns Atom, which is really weird to think about. And also this whole like chain of connection. If you think about GitHub makes Atom, okay, and then Microsoft builds VS Code probably using Atom. Like, what else would they have written it with?
Like, I think it's with Electron.
No, but I'm saying like the actual editor they used.
Right.
Other editor did they probably use to write it? So like it's just this weird like circle. Yeah, they're both written in Electron. And that's the other thing that's weird is like they're both Electron apps. And then it comes full circle because Microsoft buys GitHub. And so now they're like technically maintaining both these Electron apps that do the exact same thing. So obviously, like, I don't think they'll maintain both forks long term.
Yeah, I don't see
it. Doesn't make sense.
I don't think so either. Yeah. I made the transition to VS Code begrudgingly. And I say begrudgingly because I liked Atom because I had very minimal like plugins and it was just like a text editor.
Mm.
But the repository that I'm working on right now is like TypeScript, very TypeScript heavy. And it's like a big project. And I felt like Atom was just like really slow, even just like opening it up and starting it up. There was like that 2 to 3 second lag that was just annoying enough for me to be like, okay, maybe I should try something else.
And you're finding VS Code performance that much better?
Yeah, there's definitely like no lag. I think the TypeScript support is like just a little bit better.
Mm.
I don't know. At the end of the day, it's just a freaking editor. I still just like deep down, I just want to be like a hardcore Vim user. And I think I need to accept the fact that I'm never going to be that. But I do have Vim key bindings just to like be able to navigate and highlight things quickly.
Sure.
And like jump through lines. But yeah, I use VS Code and that's my current setup. It's okay. I'm not like one of those, because there are people that are like really into VS Code and won't like, are maybe just as annoying as people who use Vim.
Sure.
But to me, it's just like, just something I use to.
I think the JavaScript community in general is pretty much a lot of people I talk to that are really heavy JavaScript, write a lot of JavaScript all day long, are in VS Code. I think that it's just kind of where things have gone. And I feel like it's funny because in the Rails world, there's still a lot of Sublime Text people, a lot of Atom people. Like, I feel like in general, though, we're a little bit the grumpy old men in the room. We're just like, things are fine. Don't change them, which I appreciate to some degree. Because I know a lot of people who do Rails that are just still on,
Sublime.
Exactly, Sublime Text. And it works great. It's super performant on a Mac. Like, it definitely is faster than one of these hybrid, what is it? You just said it.
Electron.
Yeah, it was like an Atom app. No, it was like Electron. Yeah, sheesh.
Yeah, because Sublime is written with like C++ or something like that.
Exactly.
And it's like super fast.
Especially when you have like a huge file. Like for some reason the other day, I was directly editing some really big JavaScript file. It was a library. So I was like, I opened up for some reason you know, some library and whatever it was, like Popper JS or something. I don't remember. And I opened it in Atom and my machine just like absolutely tanked because I accidentally hit prettier on this like 2000 line JavaScript. And my machine was just like, fuck you, I can't do it. Like it just could not do it. But it's funny because if you do the same thing in Sublime Text, it actually works because it's using native code. It's not like trying to do this with a web view. It's crazy, but it's way more performant, especially for that kind of stuff. But honestly, like who needs to edit like 2000 line?
Yeah,
like, it's
very
not
seldom.
Something you need to do. So yeah, day to day. I think the only reason I haven't really switched to VS Code, because like I have it on my machine. I have all my plugins there. It works great. It just feels like Atom when I'm there. But the actual like keyboard command to open up Atom, like the Atom, like to open it up, I have in from my terminal, I haven't like aliased that or learned the new keyboard command. So the only way to open VS Code on my system is actually like navigate to it and double click it. And I never open the icon on an application ever. So my muscle memory just opens up Atom when I sit down to work every single time. I should just alias it and then it'd be done.
It's kind of funny because I think there's a built-in alias that you don't even have to configure. I think it's like, you know how with Atom, it's like Atom space period and then it'll open that like directory,
whatever your directory in, and that's what's in my muscle memory. It just happens. I don't even know what happens. I just sit down and it opens.
Yeah, I think for VS Code you can do code space period.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
But that actually fucked me up because for whatever reason I decided that the like root directory in my on my computer that holds like all of my projects, I decided to name that code. So when I do code period, it doesn't do anything.
That's funny.
So I had to make an alias that was like VS space period.
Yeah, it didn't work out of the box for me because I don't have it in my ZSH. Like I have to add that, I have to grep it or whatever into my dot files to the, get the like little symlink or whatever that's called. I don't know. I know only a little enough about dot files to do like the very basics that I need to do. I finally understand enough about them to know that I need to back them up and move them to a new machine to not have to reconfigure all my dot files, which is nice. So I learned that much.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's try to get a little bit back to the book. So I mentioned chapter 2, which is kind of designing classes with a single responsibility, which is a really good one to jump into. But my other one that I wrote down here is chapter 7, which is the idea of sharing code with modules. Okay. And this idea of kind of, in Ruby at least, including this different role into different types of classes and models. And so I wanted to share a quick story with something my team came up with, actually. I was like, hey, I really want to use modules for this specific feature. And they took it from there and we kind of worked together and found out the best way to accomplish this. So the feature we wanted to do is, you know, in Amazon, how you have the different lists, like shopping lists, and you can add stuff to your wish list. So our client wanted something where they had this idea of every user has a list and they can add many different types of objects onto their list. So basically anything on the site, they can save to their list. So whether it's like a provider, a specific service, or an organization, like there's all these different types of objects that need to be added and removed and saved to this one list. In our case, there was only one list. So every user has their own list. And it's like a favorites functionality in a way. Like I can favorite an item and it saves to my list. But they wanted it this idea and they really liked this idea of it's a user's list and their list of things. So what we really came up with is this idea of this role of listable and then this role of lister. And so we encapsulated all of the code that had to do with lists and listable and listings all into these two modules. And so basically once that was wired up and we got that defined and we included those, at this point we could include a new object as being listable by just doing include listable right at the top of the class file. And then all of a sudden that object gets all these superpowers that it can act as something that can be listable. And then we have different roles and different types of users in the platform. And so when we have introduced new roles and types, we can just include lister into that user's role. And now that user can be a lister and can curate these lists. It's got its own views, own models, own controllers. It's so much easier to test. And I'm just like so proud of moving in this direction. And more, I'm thinking in terms of what's its role? How can I modularize this thing and like get it all out of its controllers, get it all out of its, and it's even better than having its own MVC for an individual object if it's something like this, because we have to be able to list multiple types of things. So instead of having like a user's list controller and a organization's list controller, we don't have to have all those distinct controllers and functionality. We can just include these modules to them. And I've just loved it.
Super cool. Can you give me an example of like two different objects that obviously should have their own classes, but would share this idea of being a listable. So you might have like, for Amazon, it would be like, you might have books, which are like listable, because I could add a book to my list, but I could also like add a piece of fruit to my, I don't know, maybe. I don't know if you can actually like
favorite fruit. I think you can, fruit. Yeah, you can favorite fruit. So that example to me is even easier than what we were trying to do, because those are at least both products. Like I would imagine those could have some kind of inheritance that could share behavior. Like I would imagine, and I don't know the Amazon code base, but I would imagine that a banana and a lamp have similar attributes, that they have a price, they have a quantity. We were attempting to list things that have totally different attributes. So for example, this whole platform is a platform to buy and sell medical imaging services and other medical services. So we have lots of different roles on the platform. There's the idea of an organization that has many medical providers. So an organization can have doctors and nurses. And then an organization can also list their services. So they can list out an MRI or a consultation. And then also within a service, there's pricing plans. So there's a specific way you can pay for an MRI. So are you paying month over month? Are you paying one time? So there's all these different types of objects. Oh, and then on top of that, an organization has many locations. So like, are you getting an MRI at this specific location for this organization with this provider? And so all those things link together. So on our platform, you can actually list any of those things that I just said. You can list an organization specific location, which has totally different attributes than an organization. It belongs to it, but it's totally a different object. You can list a provider, which is actually a user type, which has, of course, has totally different, or a service or a specific payment type. So any of those objects that I just listed, and they all just have this nice little includable view helper that's just a little plus button, and then that just hits all this wiring and it just like works and it feels like magic. It's like it's so much functionality with such a small piece of code, and I do think there could be a downfall here. Like I think if this feature was more complex, if there needed to be more business logic in the way things are listed and unlisted, that you could run into a lot of sticking points. But I think in general, something like a like or a list or a comment even is something that you definitely can use with this kind of idea of modules. And I would strongly encourage you to look in your framework you're working in, whether it's Rails or other frameworks, have ways of including shared behavior through this roles. Like this is a base computer science concept that I honestly didn't fully understand or appreciate until going through this content and starting to implement it in code bases. And now everything I'm looking at, I'm thinking in terms of modules and including the modules and trying to share behavior, like maybe leaning into it a bit hard.
That's really cool. If you know off the top of your head, like what are some examples of the methods that these different listable items would share?
Like, for example, here, let me open it up real quick.
Live coding.
Yeah, live coding. So I'm going to open up my listable object here and just like see like what's in the listable object.
Cool.
So one of them here, lister role. So I have all these different listers. So basically, a lister has many listings as a lister. So a user can have many different types of listings. And then within a listable object, there's a lot of different attributes. And some of them we use in view helpers and other things like that. But it's like summary. So there's a summary of a listable object, which is this nice, clean method that we can either use the higher level one or the lower level one within its individual components. Because if you have, let's say, a user who is listable, we can have a summary method within the listable class, which automatically grabs, like, let's say name and does a truncate and tries that and does some of the stuff there. But we can also include a specific one within the user object that would override its other class. So there's all types of things you can do there. So most, and it's a very simple relationship for now. So there isn't a ton of view or logic related to this, because the main functionality right now is like you click the plus sign and then it shows up on your list. And then we can render those view partials from there. So as of right now, that's all we actually have is this idea of summaries on items. And then we have this nListings method that gives you the listings count for that listable object, which lets us see across different users how many people are listing that object in a really easy way. And that's encapsulated within that listable class, which is really nice.
Yeah, that's actually a really cool example of duck typing, I'm pretty sure. Just having this like shared summary method where if like a listable, whether that's a banana or I already forgot. forgot this. Your specific
banana
examples.
Or book, I think.
Whether it's a banana or a book, it may or may not have this summary method. But whatever its base class is, like product, for example, it could just rely on that.
Exactly.
And that's a pretty non-scary way of understanding what duck typing is. I was actually using duck typing just yesterday. We have this idea in Open Listings of a showing request and a tour. And this is just one of those fucked up things that has like stuck in the domain because, you know, like a tour has many showing requests. But I say it's fucked up because the way that we talk about showing requests is like sometimes we use showing request and tour interchangeably. And we're trying to change all this language to no longer even say like tour. I think we're now saying like visit. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
For these objects, though, there's a tour request, which is me requesting a tour to happen. And then a tour object that encapsulates like the scheduled tour. Would that be right? One manages the request of the tour and the other manages the actual tour?
No. So what happens is... think of it like this. You have a single tour. Tour sort of encapsulates like the whole thing. But let's say I want to visit multiple properties. Each of those properties is a showing request. So like if I want to visit some like a place in Glendale and I want to visit a place in Hollywood, I would have two showing requests on that tour.
On that tour. Interesting.
But either way, we have this like legacy code base. I say legacy and it's only like 2 or 3 years old or something like that. We have this legacy system where a tour has a time slot. And showing requests have a time slot. But the problem is that we need the tour to be like the source of truth for the time slot. And I say and I bring up source of truth because you might need to check against the time slot to see whether or not a tour is in the future or if it's in the past or if you have like conflicting time slots with other tours, things like that. But the problem is that a tour has a time slot and a showing request has a time slot. But what if the showing requests... Yeah, it's messed up. All you need to know is that there was a method on the tour model that was called there was a method on the showing request called future start, which returns a boolean.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to actually like make a method on the tour called future start as well because there are cases where you want to check future start against the showing request and there's also cases where you want to check against the tour. But if the showing request has context of the tour, you actually want to check the tour's future start method.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So hopefully that made sense. It made sense as I said it out loud. but it's this like crazy thing where they need to share like the same method name. And based on the context that showing request has, it needs to either like reach up to the tour or it needs to like use its own time slots to determine the future start. And it was like this, I was like, I don't know, this is cool. I'm using duck typing. Here it is in practice.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the whole point of this conversation. That's awesome. I love that. And those are honestly my main two things that I feel like have affected my day-to-day coding the last few weeks of going through this book is the idea of even more so leaning the idea of splitting up functionality into its own class. And then now this whole idea of splitting out functionality, shared functionality into these modules is the other that I've really been leaning into and just finding so much benefit from a design standpoint day to day, which is really exciting. And also, funny rabbit hole. So I've been exploring like the Spree and Solidus. I've been doing some e-commerce work for a client of mine and we're doing like a lot of this like high-end e-commerce stuff, which is really cool. But they want to do like some really advanced stuff. We've been pushing, and one reason I've been doing so much vanilla JS is because they're currently, some of their clients are on Shopify, which is fine. I don't love the development tooling because it's not like really owning a code base. It's not like working in Squarespace or WordPress, but it's kind of in that same genre where you don't fully own the code and like the back end. And it's like this weird middle ground with Shopify because it is kind of open source, but not really. But so we've been pushing Shopify really fucking far with vanilla JS on top of Shopify and like really pushing it far and doing a lot of really cool shit. And it's been really fun. But there's some clients of theirs that they want to start pushing more and more into deeper customization, like product and business flow customization. So we've been exploring some really good like open source libraries for e-commerce out there. So we've been playing with them all, but one that we've really landed on is Solidus, which is a fork of Spree. And what's cool about it is the whole thing is just a Rails engine and it's split into multiple Rails engines. So like they have the whole backend like model view controller for all of the products and inventory and invoices, but with headless, like there's absolutely no front end on it. It's just all the controllers and models. And so you can just include this gem, use all their controllers and models, extend or monkey patch any of their controllers or models, and then you get all your own view layer. So you just literally spin up your own view folders, put in your own ERB or whatever you want on top of it. Like, we were exploring doing different front ends on it, and it's been really interesting. But getting my head around the way modules work and extending modules was really important for starting to do even some of this exploratory work, because you don't really want to directly edit any of those underlying files. And in reality, you don't really want to monkey patch stuff in general. What you want to do is extend its functionalities with modules. And so there was this one requirement that they wanted to include instructions on how to use their products, but Solidus doesn't have any instructions tables. So what I did is I reached for a module, and so it's instructionable is I think what I went to. And so it's like that idea of now it includes this instructions tables and it can add these instructions to it, but we still get all the benefits of upgrading the underlying Rails gem when they do security updates and things like that, because we haven't monkey patched anything. We're just extending it with this module. And so it's really interesting realizing how valuable modules are for sharing code, not only within a single project, but for open source and sharing between multiple projects. And I'm like really excited and interested to lean into a Ruby gem that extends through modules. And I'm realizing more and more, like, so many gems are just modules. Like, Devise is all just a module, like includes authenticatable. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting to think of how powerful that is, because we get this entire community working on and hitting the security and making sure Devise works and works reliably. It's funny because on this exact podcast, I've talked so much shit about Devise and now I'm such a fan. But hey, we all change, right? But it's just interesting though, as an example of modules and how powerful that idea can be, even outside of the walls of a single project, you can share it across projects and include this functionality throughout so much of the web. Like, I think Devise probably handles authentication on like 10% of the web. It's incredible.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that, like, early on in your programming career, you have these ideas of, in Ruby land, it's Ruby gems. In JavaScript, they're node modules. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Python, they're some other thing. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Cocoa Pods, we got them all.
Yeah, Cocoa Pods for Swift. Every community has their own thing. And when you first start out, you just think of, like, you know, you read tutorials or you see these things and you just think of them as like this magic black box that's like somehow giving you all this all these superpowers, and it's letting you do all these cool things.
Yeah.
But then, like, you start working with these things and understanding what the hell's going on, and like, yeah, you know, the scariest thing is like peeking into the code and what it's doing. But then you realize that, like, all they are just like modules. And mm-hmm. if you really wanted to see like what some really tiny JavaScript open source thing is doing, you can literally just like pop open that folder and then see what the hell you're including in your app. And it's like literally just all right there.
Yeah. It's so scary to think of how many gems I included early in my career without even opening up the folders and understanding what they are. Because this is the first thing I do now. Like, I look at the contributions, make sure there's recent contributions, make sure there isn't a ton of stale open issues. Like, those are the first two things mm-hmm. I do. But then, like, the next thing I do is open the code. And I think to myself, like, could I maintain this or fix this or understand how this works? And if the answer is no for me right now, I don't start to include them. But I think that you're totally right. It was like, they were just a black box before, whether it's an NPM module or a gem. Like, I think NPM modules are still a black box for me, if I was honest. But definitely Ruby gems is something that I understand and I like can get my head around what I'm including. And I think that's an important lesson and takeaway and something to keep in mind. Because I was in this middle ground of this, like, I had pretty good Ruby and Rails skills. And then I thought, like, oh, this is all stupid. I don't need it. I'll just fucking build it myself. But then, like, not only am I not leveraging the power of the community, but like, it was just this bad arrogance that was like, oh, I know better than it. But then at the same time, I wasn't even opening the library and looking at what it was. Like, I didn't even understand the library. So it's mm-hmm. this terrible middle ground of, I didn't understand the library and I had the balls to talk shit about it. I don't know. Whatever. We're all silly sometimes.
Yeah. And so, yeah, one cool example of like, just like looking at the source code is for this, like, for our mobile app. We wanted this like custom popover thing, and all of the solutions provided online like were just like not enough, or it was like too much, just so that mm-hmm. it was like too much in the sense that if we wanted to get what we wanted to do, we'd have to pass in all these custom props, and we'd have right. to, and we wouldn't be using
basically
like
rewriting it on the fly.
Yeah. And then we wouldn't even be using like more than half of the library. And so we just mm-hmm. like built it from scratch. But like, it was really nice to be able to like peek into the code base to see like what they were doing and to get a head start, you know?
I did that with a whole invoices module that I was looking through. I was like, oh, maybe like there's, because I'm like more open to using gems because I understand them more. I was like, maybe there's like a gem that just gets me started with the basic invoicing system. And I like looked in the way they built it and I was like, okay, I'm not going to use this gem, but I'm definitely stealing some of their ideas, like breaking out an invoice item from its invoice class. Like they did a lot of smart stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, that's how they set up the payee and who's a requester. And I was like, okay, this is kind of cool. But you're totally right. Like, opening that and getting your head around it lets you get quick wins and seeing some of the mistakes they've made or the right directions they've gone implementing some of this stuff. And yeah, there's so many solved, in a sense, solved or people who have attempted to solve problems. Like, let's use that and leverage that for sure.
Yeah, totally. Should we introduce the next book we're going to be talking about?
Yeah. Do you want to give it the honor? I forgot. That was like one of the points of this mid-episode is to introduce the next book. I finally got mine. It's right here behind me. It's been behind me recording the whole time. Look at that.
So without further ado, the book that we will be discussing on the next episode is a book by Martin Fowler, who's big in the computer science / programming community. And the book is called Refactoring, Improving the Design of Existing Code, the second edition. And so the first edition was written, I think, over a decade ago. But what's cool about this new edition is that not only is it up to date, but it's written with JavaScript examples. Mm-hmm. Which is like definitely going to be easier to like grok and read through versus like
the old one was like Python or C, wasn't it? Or was it Java?
I think it was Java, which is honestly not even that hard to read. But I'm still very resistant to like reading, to like wanting to understand anything that isn't JavaScript or Ruby, which is definitely on me. But it wouldn't be.
Yeah,
it's like not even that big of a deal to read like Java, but it's cool because we'll have like a total understanding of what's going on. And I've already started reading the first couple chapters. It's going to be a fun one to talk about for sure.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I just got my book yesterday or the day before, so I haven't dug into the book yet, but I'm just like even perusing the pages, I'm really excited to get into it. And actually the fact that it's written in JavaScript is exciting to me as well, like all the examples, because I feel like it'll help me up my game in JavaScript. And I hope to kind of on the fly a little bit in these conversations, kind of translate some of the examples to Ruby a bit. So it's like, well, in Ruby, it would be this, and in other frameworks as much as possible. I think the content in this is, so far I can tell, it doesn't matter if you write JavaScript every day or write Ruby every day. There's a lot of fundamental approaches to how you approach refactoring that are going to be pay off really huge. And I'm really excited to talk through it in upcoming conversations. It's going to be really good.
Totally.
Do you have any picks this week, JP?
Yeah. So my pick for this week is a fucking nerdy ass pick. And it's this website called Geeks for Geeks. It's geeksforgeeks.org. And their like little subtitle is a computer science portal for geeks. And it's basically just this resource that has a bunch of stuff on like algorithms and system design and like practice problems. I don't know. I thought it was a cool resource that I've like never heard of before.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. My pick is a quick one. It's thispersondoesnotexist.com.
Oh.
And it freaks me the hell out. And it's actually really awesome for like placeholder images for avatars and stuff. So what this is, it is AI generated people.
What?
And they look completely real. But if you start to look at the detail, like their eyebrows or their ears, the ears is where it always fucks it up. Or the earrings, like if it's a woman, the earring will be like hanging in her hair. So what the idea here is that these are fully algorithmically generated people. None of these people are real. So you just reload the page and a new person pops up and it looks like a real photo of a person with hair and eyes. And like, it doesn't look fake at all. It just looks like a photograph of a person.
Dude.
But none of these people are real.
What the hell?
None of them are real.
This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. You know, this is interesting because have you heard this thing where the people that you see in your dreams are people you've seen in real life? Like, your brain can't manifest.
Make up a face?
Yeah, cannot, like, make up something, like a face that you've never seen before. This, like, totally turns that, like, idea upside down because these are, like, generated faces. This is so creepy. Like, these people
do
not exist.
It's creepy as hell. They don't exist. And you can tell, like, some of the features. Like, I'm looking at someone right now whose hairline looks like a woman's hairline, but then it's a man's cut and the face is very masculine, but then the eyebrows are feminine. Like, it's interesting, too, because a lot of the faces are somewhat androgynous. And because the computer doesn't really know the differences between a man and a woman to a large degree. Mm-hmm. And so like you get these kind of sometimes a little bit androgynous people. The weird thing is when people have glasses, they're these like weird droopy. That's the only time it really fucks up is when people have glasses. Mm. Beyond that, like it's really eerie how realistic the people look. So I guess this is from a researcher. If you just Google around, you'll find more information on it. But it's a researcher using some newer AMD technology that's doing some machine learning stuff. And I guess the original data set, something like 100,000 faces, but you would think that it's just like combining this person's eyes and this person's mouth, but it's not doing that. Like I was kind of looking through the white paper a bit, which is way over my head, but it's actually algorithmically generating everything. It's not just like, I thought it was just kind of piecing shit together, but that's not at all what's going on here. This is fully like every pixel of this image is generated algorithmically. It is not like piecing together images.
Wow, that might be the coolest thing I've seen.
And they look completely photorealistic.
Dude, they
yeah,
look so
I'm
real.
Really into it. Ooh, this one looks really creepy and not real at all. Ooh, that one's really weird. It's this little girl that's like all droopy. Ugh. Okay, but it's kind of fun. I just can sit here and refresh this for so
long.
Yeah,
me too.
But I actually already used one of them for a placeholder image because it's so nice because it's like, well, I know the person doesn't exist, so I can throw it in a sketch mock-up and not even think about it. I really want to make like a plugin that like grabs a bunch and throws them in a folder for you to use. It'd be cool to make a sketch plugin that uses this.
Dude, that is super cool. Wow. And this is like the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
I'm glad you like it. All right. Well, I'm super excited for our next book. We are going to be taking a couple weeks off. I think 2 weeks off, but no promises. It might be three between books. Just kind of catch up, get some episodes in the queue, take 1 week off from recording. But we're really excited to jump into the next book and we'll be seeing you guys soon. We really appreciate all the new listeners coming in and everybody talking on Twitter, and we appreciate it. Please reach out to us in the meantime. Catch some back episodes. Like if you miss season one has been erased from the face of this planet. But if you miss season two, go back and listen to that book because it was really great. Season one sucked, so that's why we deleted it. Thanks so much for listening and we'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
All right. Thank you so much and peace.